This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from
the Westin in Long Beach, California. I've been coming to Long Beach for, my goodness, 47 years, since I was a baby working for Newsweek magazine in Los Angeles. And when I first came down here, there was a ship parked here, and it's still here. It's the Queen Mary, and one of the heaviest and most popular visited attractions in the city. And my next guest began his career on that ship 37 years ago and is still there today. He's the Commodore of the Queen Mary, Captain Everett Horn. How are you?
I'm well, Peter. So good to see you.
I called you Captain. It's really Commodore.
Oh, it's all good.
You'll take Commodore.
I'll take everything.
Yes, and I'll salute later on. it was a great publicity stunt at the time they first brought it in. I don't know if they ever really thought it would last this long, but it has.
You know, Peter, I don't know if anyone could have known that the Queen Mary would still be here in Long Beach 51 years after Captain Jones dropped her off here along with his 1,000 passengers. But over these years, the popularity of the ship has grown and continues to grow. And these days, we're seeing between 1.6 and 1.8 million visitors every year.
And for people who don't know this, this is not just a museum you go to visit. You can stay overnight. You can eat. It's a hotel. How many people got married there last year?
Oh, well, we're doing about 250, 260 weddings every year. About half of them I officiate myself, which is a great pleasure of the job.
All right. Has anybody ever stood up and opposed the marriage?
Not yet.
But you still have to say those words.
Well, no, we don't leave that in the script.
Oh, that's gone now. You're covering your bases now.
Okay. Oh, exactly. Yes.
Okay. But it's a very popular destination. Now, this, as popular as it is, talk about maintenance. This ship requires 24/7 maintenance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, it's 81,237 gross tons of biodegradable materials floating in salt water. So we never get done taking care of the ship. It's an ongoing thing, but it is a labor of love, and the ship has become such an icon, not only to our city, but Southern California. I've always felt that the ship was our Eiffel Tower, or our Big Ben, our Statue of Liberty. It's such a symbol of our community now. How many people have had their proms there? How many people have been married there? How many Christmas celebrations? How many celebrations? I mean, even Michael Jackson had a big birthday party back in the 70s when. So there's always something new and interesting going on at the ship.
To me, and I had a chance to, it's another story I'll explain later, but I got a chance to helicopter myself today. I flew the helicopter right over the top of it, over the Queen Mary. And of course, what do I see? The distinctive three stacks, right? You don't see ships with three stacks anymore.
No, the Queen Mary was the last three-stacked liner in the world. And to my knowledge, it's the only one left in the world. And those funnels, which are biggest
castles.
But one
of them was ornamental, wasn't it?
Well, actually, Peter, the Queen Marys are all functional. There were some ships that did have some ornamental ones, like the Normandy. Her third one was ornamental. But in the Titanic, her fourth one was ornamental.
A lot of good it did that ship.
The number of funnels, a lot of people think that the Titanic is just so much larger than the Queen Mary because it had four funnels. But, you know, that was really went back to the mindset of the immigrant. They felt in those days, if ships had more funnels, that they were larger and safer to travel in.
Well, same thing happened with airplanes. Until we got much more efficient engines, every plane had to be four engines. In fact, there's still a law that the United States president can only be flown on a plane that has four engines that's built in the United States. That's why the president continues to get flown on a 747, because the only plane still made in the United States with four engines is the 747, and Boeing has kept up the production line that they even wanted to close on the 747 to produce two more of the Air Force One type planes before they shut the production line down. So same thing happened with planes. Mm.
It's my dream someday, Peter, to see the Queen of the Sky do a low overpass of the Queen of the Seas over there.
Well, they better hurry up, because Delta's retired theirs, United's retired theirs. So if it was the Queen of the Sky to do it, you still have a chance with British Air. They still have a flight that leaves Los Angeles every day that is a 747. Well, the other flight is an A380, so you still have a shot, but you better talk to them soon.
I will.
Yeah. What's the biggest surprise to you after 37 years being on the Queen Mary about the ship?
The biggest surprise is that she lives, that she's still viable, and that she's still so popular to so many.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me.
I always like to ask the locals where they go and what they do, and my next guest knows a little bit about that. He's the executive editor of an improbable name of a newspaper, but we love it, the Grunion Gazette. And if you don't know what a grunion is, then you don't live in Southern California, but we'll talk about that later. His name is Harry Saltzgaver. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
Thanks. All right, let's solve the mystery. Tell everybody what a grunion is.
A grunion is a little silver fish who comes up on the beach to, let's say, procreate.
And they have grunion runs out here.
All the time, yeah.
And you'll see people on the beach with their pails and running after these fish, right?
Yeah, actually people eat these things. But it is a lot of fun to just go out and watch them do what they do.
What's for dinner tonight, honey? Not grunion again. Have you ever eaten a grunion?
I have to say I have not.
And how long have you been the executive editor of the Grunion Gazette?
A little more than 26 years now.
And not a grunion in your body?
No, it's true. I've been out hunting them a few times, but I haven't eaten one.
That explains your last cover story, the elusive grunion.
There you go.
I know. But in this 26 years, let's get serious. Long Beach has gone from essentially a sleepy community, it was sleepy, mm-hmm. to like cutting edge.
Right.
Why? How?
Well, actually because the Navy left and because the aerospace industry left.
And I remember, by the way, my grandfather was Donald Douglas's assistant. Mm-hmm. So I came down, when I was growing up, I was down in Long Beach all the time, and in Santa Monica, because that's where Douglas really was, but they were mm-hmm. working down here,
right.
Watching them build the DC-9s, the DC-10s, mm-hmm. the tankers, all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, when Boeing bought the Douglas, they slowly just took everything away. They left the passenger jets first, and then the last thing that was built
the military.
Was the military.
The C-17.
Exactly, yeah. And they're gone now, too.
Well, I was out at the airport today, and so many of those hangars are either being repurposed or they're empty.
That's right, yeah. It is still a very strong general aviation airport.
Oh, listen, it's a great alternate airport for anybody.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to wait. The security lines are a breeze. And for those people who don't remember this, go back and look at the movie Casablanca, the last scene in the movie, right. with Humphrey Bogart walking out in that very foggy night with Ingrid Bergman as that plane was ready to take off. All of that was shot right here at the airport. Right? We'll always have Paris.
That's right.
Or we'll always have Long Beach, if the truth be told.
Exactly.
Right? And they still don't have jetways here.
Right.
You still go up and down the planes the old-fashioned way.
That's right. You have to climb the stairs.
You do. You do.
So the airport is actually a good example of what's happened to Long Beach altogether. It's still got the Art Deco terminal that you were talking about, but at the same time, it's cutting edge in terms of the passenger terminal.
And let's talk about what happened, God, 18 years ago with JetBlue. Mm-hmm. You know, they did something very, very smart. They were trying to start Transcon service as a new airline, mm-hmm. and they knew L.A. was congested. They knew San Francisco was congested. There weren't very many slots available. And they looked around. They said, what's an airport in California that has available slots? Well, there are like 32 of them at Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And so the owner of JetBlue, or the manager, a guy named David Neilman, came out and said, you know what? We'll take all 32. Mm-hmm. And they did. And it drove the other airlines batty. Mm-hmm. And yet JetBlue made it work. I remember American Airlines came in with four flights a day to Long Beach with triple mileage. They couldn't compete.
Right.
JetBlue is the dominant carrier.
Right. Still is. The thing that they did when they started flying, it was August 29th, 2001.
Yeah.
You might remember what happened 13 days later.
I was on the... Listen, August 29th, 2001, I did that show live for the Today Show with me on the very first plane at Kennedy as it was taking off for Long Beach.
Yeah, right.
Wow. With David Neilman, who was the chairman.
Right.
And, you know, 13 days later, right?
You're right.
September 11th.
But they persevered and made it through, and they've made it really a success, I think.
Yep, and the airport works.
Yes, still does.
I know. I mean, if you look at Southern California airports that work, Burbank works, Long Beach works, and I have to give a little credit to San Diego. They still work, even though they've done some pretty rapid expansion. Mm-hmm. LAX, I'm sorry, doesn't cut it, either in design or actual, you know, function.
Right.
And that's just Southern California. Ontario's had their problems. A lot of people were pulling out, and the concessionaires were dying. Mm-hmm. But sooner or later, they'll come back because they have a big population base in that area. But Long Beach is the secret airport. You can even fly, what, Long Beach to Hawaii now.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Hawaiian Air started 6 months ago, something like that.
So that's all very cool.
Right.
Okay, but other than the airport, what's changed?
Well, the entire waterfront has changed. Yeah. As I said, when the Navy left and when the aerospace left, we had to reinvent ourselves. And the mayor at the time, Beverly O'Neill, touted tourism, trade, and retail. And she started the entire renovation of the waterfront. Now we've got maybe the best aquarium in the world. We've got waterfront restaurants, the waterfront, lots of waterfront entertainment. And, of course, we've got still got the Queen Mary.
Yeah, so, Spruce Goose is flown. Well, not really flown, but it's been trucked.
Well, it got taken apart.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
A plane that only flew once.
That's right.
Only flew once.
Still a tourist attraction, I believe, in Oregon.
It is. That's where it is now. But I remember the old newsreels. Howard used the controls, and it got maybe, what, 18 to 20 feet off the water?
About that, yeah.
And that was it.
Yep,
and then Air Force said, see ya, and he went, see ya, and that was that.
Yeah.
That was a big plane.
It was, and now we still got the dome, and there's a different travel industry in there right now.
But what Long Beach has embraced is the reality of the importance economically of travel and tourism.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the dome is now Carnival Cruise Line's major departure area for this area of the country.
We're talking to Harry Seltzgaber, who's the executive editor of the Grunion Gazette. Do you actually publish Grunion recipes?
No, we don't.
Okay, I had to ask. Okay.
We do publish Grunion Run times, though, occasionally.
Sort of like, here's the tide table, and here's when the Grunion are running.
Exactly right.
For somebody who's never been to Long Beach, and they come for the first time, or people who are coming to visit you as friends and relatives, what's the one thing that surprises them the most when they get here?
I think the diversity of things to do and places to go, people to see, things to eat. We're a great secret when it comes to diverse food. We've got everything from Vietnamese and Thai to upper-scale steakhouses. So.
And the number of restaurants has grown exponentially.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's the one thing that seems to survive no matter what.
You know, the one challenge of any community that's growing as fast as you are how do you balance that growth when you also have people like Airbnb and Uber and Lyft coming in and all of a sudden taking away, or at least the accusation being, taking away from the traditional travel businesses?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're experiencing some of that, but I don't think a whole lot. We have seen a boom in hotel construction in the last couple of years. There's one going up right now over by the airport. And we're seeing a couple others who should start in the next year here downtown.
So the growth continues.
Always, yeah.
All right, but now, Harry, you got to make me a promise.
Yes, sir.
The next time you go Grunion running, you got to send me a picture of you with a Grunion.
Okay, I'll do that.
Are you telling me the truth?
I am indeed.
Are you going to do it?
Of course I will.
Because my audience needs to know what a Grunion looks like.
Well, think sardine, only a little bigger. And you got
the charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4.
Over the seas and all the degrees to anywhere I please.
My next guest has the dream job of all dream jobs. And if I wasn't doing what I was doing, I'd probably be hanging out with him every day of the week. He's the president and CEO of the Aquarium of the Pacific right here in Long Beach, Dr. Jerry Schubel. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting us.
I remember when you opened, and I remembered all the exhibits from day one. And you always basically proclaimed yourself to be an interactive experience.
And we're more interactive now than we have ever been.
And I remember when the Monterey Aquarium opened up in Northern California, their big attraction was I could go pet a jellyfish and I could go pet a starfish. You go beyond that, don't you?
You can pet a shark at our place. We were the first aquarium in the country to let you pet a shark.
The shark doesn't pet you?
So far, we haven't lost any fingers or hands.
What kind of shark is it?
Well, they're small sharks, but they're all kinds of little sharks, maybe 3 feet long.
I mean, you've taken this aquarium, I mean, in terms of your attendance, in terms of its popularity, it's like, I would have to think it's the main attraction here in Long Beach.
Oh, it is by far. Last year we had 1.72 million visitors. We'll end this year about the same. Next year, after we open our new wing, we'll have 1.8. And then when we have the new wing open for a full year, we expect to top 2 million visitors.
And this is not your first aquarium.
No, this is not my first aquarium. I was at the New England Aquarium for 7 years.
And this aquarium is different because?
Well, I think being in Long Beach gives us the opportunity to create a very different kind of an aquarium, because there's no science center in this city of nearly 500,000 people. And so we've been able to combine the best of aquariums with the best of science centers and even incorporated some of the qualities of art museums.
That's, so you're not just an aquarium that people can just go and watch. You're a teaching institution.
Very much. We're very much a teaching institution for people of all ages. We have programs for kids, for adults, and we have a lecture every week. We have an aquatic academy that gives courses in the spring and the fall. So, yes, we're a teaching institution.
Now, I remember in Atlanta going to that aquarium, which is amazing, and seeing the albino, well, I guess they're whales.
Yes.
What would be your star attraction here?
Well, sharks are always the most popular, and sea otters and penguins are close. I think, though, we have all the quality.
Well, sea otters are cute.
They're cute. They're also
penguins are also cute, but yeah. Penguins are nasty.
Otters are nastier.
I remember dealing with penguins, and I had to have gloves up to my shoulders, heavily reinforced, because they'll just bite you to death.
Yes, and otters will smile at you and then bite you.
And you're speaking from experience?
No, I've never had one bite me, but we have had people.
You've seen the deceptive smile.
Yes.
But you say the sharks are your number one attraction.
I would say so, yeah. But really, as I say, what makes us different, we have all the qualities that one would expect of a great aquarium. Live animal exhibits of fish, marine birds, marine mammals, invertebrates. But that's only the beginning. It's all of these other things that we've added on, not only the interactivity, but, for example, with our expansion, it focuses entirely on the one animal on this planet that's putting all the other animals at risk. And that's us.
I knew you were going there.
And it will have some live animal exhibits, but the focus is on us and the changing relationship of people with the Earth and the world ocean, and what it's going to take to get us back onto some track to sustainability.
Well, I saw the story the other day that really bothered me, and I'm sure you saw the same story and it bothered you, about the dead whale and what was in its stomach.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the ocean. A lot of it is plastic, abandoned fishing gear and so on that animals ingest. And that's a serious problem. I think a more serious problem, though, that's harder to correct, is the warming of the ocean, getting it more acidic, and also the loss of oxygen in the ocean at all depths.
And how do you possibly control that?
Well, we focus a lot on that, and there's no single simple answer. But it's very clearly, the science is clear about climate change. What's less clear is, what do you do about it? It's obvious that we have to reduce and probably eliminate any further emissions of greenhouse gases. But there's a big enough inventory of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we're going to have to be bold and courageous and figure out how do you remove it and lock it away so we can go back to a climate that we people can thrive in.
But we're seeing change right now negatively at an almost exponential pace.
That's right. That's the world is changing more rapidly than at any time in the 200,000 years of human history. And many animals and plants can't keep up. That's why the people say we're on the verge of the sixth mass extinction. So we have to slow down the rate of change and let nature catch up.
We're talking with Dr. Jerry Schubel, giving us the enlightening and very heartening news, but stuff we have to pay attention to, the president and CEO of the Aquarium of the Pacific. I've always said, Doctor, that if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. You take an active role in letting the public measure things.
Yes, we do. We have citizen science programs that involve people. They're identifying whales on some of the Harbor Breeze cruises. They're identifying turtles, green turtles.
Are you tagging the whales too?
No, we're working with other organizations
that
tag
that.
Whales, and
right.
So we keep an inventory.
Amazing. And then also, I'm going to assume this now, you say you have programs for kids. Do you have sleepovers?
We do have sleepovers.
All right, now we're talking.
We have sleepovers not only for kids, but for families and adults.
And what happens during the sleepovers? The sharks get up and dance.
The octopus comes out. The octopus.
Oh, come on, stop.
And they don't. They hide a lot, but at night they come out and display their colors.
They really do.
And yes, they do. You know, one of the things that we've tried to do, you've heard that Long Beach is this wonderful city with a lot of ethnic diversity, and we get the most ethnically diverse audience of any aquarium in the world, and we work hard at that with festivals, more than 12 a year, that bring people in. We turn the aquarium over to different groups for weekends, and the only thing that we require is they talk a little bit about what their culture means to the ocean, or the ocean means to them. There are these places that are called third places in society, the places we live, places we work. And then the third place is places where we gather, get together, exchange ideas.
And if we don't do that, we lose society.
We lose society. And so we've become the third place in downtown Long Beach.
I have to tell you a sort of an admission. You mentioned octopus. When I was growing up, I remember the movie. It was Peter Lorre was in the movie. It was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And what do I remember most about the movie, other than Peter Lorre talking like this? I remember the octopus, right. That giant octopus,
right.
Remember?
Right, that was a squid, but there's not an octopus.
Oh,
thanks
a lot, Doctor. I've lived all my life worried about octopus.
That's okay.
But it made an impact on me.
And Peter Lorre was a good counterpart to
he
that
was.
Squid.
He
yes.
was. I always wanted to do a Peter Lorre film festival because he always talked like this, and I don't know about the octopus. Maybe it was a squid. Do you have a film festival?
Well, we have a lot of films. And we're going to be having the North American premiere of a film, actually, on January the 6th. It's about the ocean, and we have panel discussions. And you heard earlier, I think, that we had one with the Cambodian community, Angelina Jolie. So we're a place where people like to come to have premieres of their films. And we actually have Aquaman coming.
Now we're talking.
And and that's coming up in about 2 weeks, I guess.
Well, when you do the Peter Lorre Retrospective Film Festival and you do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you let me know so I can correct everybody. It's not an octopus. It's a squid.
All right. We'll get a hold of you.
Now, you also do something with an aquatic academy.
Yes. We have. This is something that we created maybe a decade ago. And we give a short course each spring and each fall. And they're spread over 4 weeks, and they are enough hours so that a teacher can get continuing education credit. And we limit the size to 45 students so they can have interaction with experts that are recruited from all over the country. And we always pick a topic that's complex, controversial, and timely. So we've done some on farming the sea, climate change, genetically modified foods, and we just finished one a few weeks ago, and the title was How Will We Feed an Additional 2 to 2.5 billion People by 2100?
And that's such an important thing for me to talk about because, you know, when I go to the store and I want to buy salmon, there's the free-range salmon, if you will, the wild salmon,
right.
And then there's the farm-raised salmon. And if you do your homework on how the salmon is raised in the farm, how they add the color, how all this other stuff is happening, and then you put that in context with how many people we have to feed, is there any way to reverse that cycle so that we're not all eating some questionable farmed fish?
Much of the farm salmon is, it's not questionable at all. It's every bit as good of quality, good as taste. It's farmed sustainably. And the other thing is that wild salmon is only certain times of the year when there are wild runs, and it's much more expensive.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
My next guest is the executive director of a facility that's almost going to be 70 years old in about a year. And most people who come to Long Beach are not even aware it's here. And it's got quite a story to tell. His name is Ron Nelson, and he runs the Long Beach Museum of Art. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Almost 70 years old.
Almost 70 years old. And for a bricks and mortar institution, arts institution in Southern California, we're old. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're still below the radar. I mean, there are people just, you know, when they come to Long Beach, they're coming to a convention, or maybe they're going to the Aquarium of the Pacific, or they're visiting the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
Not that many people know you got a great museum of art.
Yeah, thank you. It is a great museum of art. We're located like 1.2 miles out of downtown. And sometimes that feels like, eons, but other times it happens very quickly for people to drive by us but not actually come in and take a look. So
and
we're working.
What distinguishes your collection or collections?
You know, the collection since 1950 has always collected contemporary Southern California artists' work. That work in the 50s, 60s, and 70s continued to be collected, but now that we're looking back at the 50s, and 60s, and 70s, it really does become an important collection because it really is who's who of all of those years together.
So I'm assuming you have a Hockney.
You assume correctly.
I was just a lucky guess, but when you think of a definitive California artist, David Hockney would come to mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who
absolutely.
Else?
Well, we have Claire Falkenstein. Claire was an amazing sculptor who's just now coming into her own. She worked a lot in Paris. She worked a lot in Venice with Peggy Guggenheimen in New York. But she was a Long Beach girl. And she, you know, when I say girl, she died at 88, but she did some really amazing pieces. And we have been fortunate to have a number in our collection. Bob McLaughlin, and we have Henry Botero, and it goes on and on. It's a pretty...
Botero?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What from Botero?
It's a cat, actually.
A very fat cat.
How did you guess? It is a very fat cat, yeah.
What's the biggest surprise for people who come to the museum that they're not expecting to see?
I don't think they're expecting the actual ground that it's on. It's on a bluff overlooking the Pacific. And it's a wonderful, wonderful viewpoint. And I think once you have that mindset and once you recognize that coming in, it takes on a very special quality. And to be able to bring people inside after having this really wonderful experience with nature, even though it may be just a minute or two walk from the parking lot, is significant. And I think it really sets a tone for the museum itself.
Now, in the museum world, and I'm sure you've been victimized by this, and I was when I was a correspondent for Newsweek, because we're all west of the Hudson River. And there's that, you know, that continuing sentiment back in the East that there's no there in California, as they used to say, that there's no culture out here. And I know you would beg to differ.
I would beg to differ. What Paris became, or what New York became to Paris after World War II, Los Angeles is becoming to New York. There are major galleries coming in and building large, large galleries. And this is at a time when the art market is really hot, but it's also changing because of the internet. So there are major major players coming here to Los Angeles. And
they want to be here.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Now, how would you define, within that definition, classical art in the museum?
Putting definitions on that is going to be difficult.
I know.
And that's why I'm getting the question, I would presume.
You guessed correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we're fortunate also that we have a collection of European modernism from the 30s and 40s. And it's a significant holdings also. And it's not just Southern California with that. But we also we share that with the Norton Simon in Pasadena, and we loan those works out internationally continually. And I think that those being thought of as classic pieces, indeed, those we do. But I also love being able to take a complete left-hand turn and have everybody sort of expecting what's going to be inside, but then stepping inside and going, I had no idea I was going to experience that. And
well, what surprised me about the museum is your archive of video art.
It's huge. It's internationally. I can be anywhere in the world, and I will say what I do and where I'm from. And though a lot of people don't realize we're there, they recognize that archive. And that was built over a period of 25 years.
Has it all been digitized?
It is in works. It's actually at the Getty. The archive was transferred to the Getty, to the GRI Institute, about 12 years ago. And they
now, and they're still working on it.
They are still working on it. And they're going to be working on it for a long time.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. Joining me now, I love his title, the Chief Inspiration Officer, whatever that means, of CAT, Justin Rudd. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Now, I know you're a transplant from Alabama, so I'll speak more slowly. No, I'm kidding. Okay. I just did that for you.
Okay.
And I don't like your football team. But other than that, you know why?
Why?
They're a pro team.
Yeah.
Come on.
They're pretty good, huh?
They could beat most pro teams.
They're pretty great.
They're pretty great. But let's get into serious stuff. CAT.
So I run a nonprofit organization called Community Action Team, which is an acronym CAT. We do a lot of DOG stuff, though. Dog stuff. We help clean the beaches, and we do events and projects that help people, especially young people.
Well, you do what they call beach boot camps.
I do. So I've been teaching beach boot camps since I first moved to Long Beach, and I also teach at the local athletic club, the Belmont Athletic Club.
Okay, what does that mean?
So for beach boot camps, what it is we go on the sand and do push-ups and sit-ups and squats, and we run through sand, run stairs, jump over concrete walls that are already standing. We use what's on the beach, like sand dunes, to run up and down sand dunes to work your legs and get your heart rate elevated.
So basically a paramedic standing by.
Pretty much. Everybody has a phone we can call 911. That's our paramedic.
Well, that's very helpful.
And lifeguards on the beach can also help anytime.
All right, but let's get serious. I come to Long Beach to vacation or come to a convention or I'm down for the weekend. How do I get involved?
Well, if you want to work with our organization, we do beach cleanups every single month. If you just want to go to the beach and pick up some debris, I can help you with that. I can arrange bags and gloves. But if you're here on the third Saturday of any month, and whether it's rain or shine, we're out there cleaning the beach at 10 o'clock.
And that's where, you know, if you're going to be here then, that's where you meet everybody who lives here.
Yeah. So, for example, the last beach cleanup that we did, we had 270 volunteers out there. But an average beach cleanup would have about 150 volunteers.
You know, it's been my contention, and it's not particular to Long Beach, it's anywhere, that people will go to a place and they'll hang out at the hotel, but they'll never leave the hotel or they'll never leave the resort. This is an opportunity to leave the resort and get on the beach and help out.
That's right. And here in Long Beach, there's so many days of sun. I think 245 or whatever that number is, 345. So it is almost always sunny here. And the beach where we happen to have our beach cleanup is also right next to Rosie's Dog Beach, which I started about 18 years ago. And it's named after my English bulldog, Rosie, who passed away.
And what happens on Rosie's Beach?
Well, people can bring their dog and they can be off. The dog can be off leash. The
now we're
can
talking.
Be off leash.
No, we need a lot of people on leashes. You
yes,
know that.
Yes, I do.
Yes.
So this is Rosie's Dog Beach. It's 4 acres and it's the only off leash legal dog beach in Los Angeles County.
And how many people met on that beach and got married?
A lot.
I knew it. The dog is always the magnet.
Yeah. So on a sunny weekend afternoon at one time, there's probably 200 dogs at one time. It's that popular. It's by far the most
popular. 200 dogs with their single owners.
Yeah. Single and available. And they all have that thing in common. They're dog lovers. So they appreciate dogs and respect the breed. And they're there to recreate the people and the dogs.
And being the transplant from Alabama, what was Long Beach all about for you? How did you get here?
I came first to North Hollywood because of a relationship, and then I was in North Hollywood for two years, and the
relationship headed south.
Yes, and I literally headed south to Long Beach, and fell in love with it and have stayed. So I've been in Long Beach for about 21 of the 23 years that I've been in California.
Was Long Beach essentially an accident for you?
Sort of an accident, but I think God always has a perfect plan for our life, and I think it was meant for me to be here because I have found my place. I could not be doing all of the things that I'm doing back in Alabama. All this nonprofit work. I put on 60 events, contests, and projects a year. So, and I couldn't do that in Alabama. There's not a big enough audience.
Yeah.
So here in Southern California, there is.
What's the website?
My website is my name, justinrudd.com, and Rudd is R-U-D-D.
And that's how people can find more out about CAT.
Absolutely. And you go there, and all of the volunteer opportunities will be there as well.
Now, let's say I don't have a dog.
Sure.
Can I still show up with the dog? Will you provide me a dog?
Yes, you can borrow my dog, POTUS. His name is POTUS. That means President of the United States. Yeah. And POTUS will go with anybody, probably anywhere, and especially if there's food involved. One of the other good things about Long Beach is that it is legal for dogs to be on patios. A lot of cities don't allow dogs on patios. So if you're bringing your dog on your vacation with you, take your dog on patios at restaurants.
So it's a dog-friendly restaurant location.
Yeah, all over the city. The restaurant owner or manager can decide whether or not they would allow dogs, but most of them do.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
For those of you who are not familiar with Long Beach, it's one of the great hidden gems of Southern California, a city that has really, really become a go-to destination in the last couple of years after being forgotten for many years, not just on the radar for many people, but it's such a cool place. It's 50 square miles in area, and it's home to more than 460,000 people. It's actually the seventh largest city in the state of California, and by that definition, it's also a melting pot. And as a melting pot, that leads me directly to my next guest. She's the executive director of the United Cambodian Community, and she was born and raised in Long Beach, California. Her name is Susanna Sim.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I remember, and I'm going to date myself now, okay? I remember going back to 1975 in the fall of Vietnam, and I was working for Newsweek then, and going back down to Camp Pendleton to rescue some of our own Vietnamese who used to work for Newsweek who we airlifted out. And what a large community now has developed in Southern California of Vietnamese, Cambodians as well.
Correct. So Long Beach has the largest population of Cambodians outside of Asia.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yes, go
ahead. Why Long Beach?
Why Long Beach? Because of the weather is very similar to the Cambodian weather. But also back in the early 1970s, there was a small group of Cambodian students that were studying here at Cal State Long Beach and Cal State LA. And they were already here. And when the Khmer Rouge happened, they remained
stayed
here.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
So a lot of the family members that were refugees immigrated here to the United States and had family members that were still here in Long Beach. So, for example, my family, we were sponsored by a family in Kansas, and my family lived there for 3 months during the Halloween winter time.
And you were too young to remember. You weren't even born.
It was before my time.
I knew it.
And it was too cold, and so we had cousins that lived out here in Long Beach.
Exactly. But you know what? That's how you discovered Kansas.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
Now, is Long Beach a sister city with Phnom Penh?
It is. And so there is a sister city with Phnom Penh. And I don't know too much about that relationship, but there's a lot of connections around business between the Cambodian community and here in Long Beach.
By the way, 2018 was the year that the final member of Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge died. Mm-hmm. He just died a couple of weeks ago. And what a horrendous time that was. For those people who were either too young to remember or who just never got around to see it, go see the movie The Killing Fields. Sam Waterston, I think. Yeah. Watch that movie. It's all true, and it all happened. Mm-hmm. And when you go to Phnom Penh, there is an amazing museum. I've been there, where you actually see the atrocities that were perpetrated on so many innocent people and families that were destroyed. And they've kept those cells just as they were so that people will never forget. It's sort of the Cambodian version of Auschwitz, if you will. I mean, it's
right. And it was a school before. And they turned it into a place where they tortured and executed individuals.
So when you say you're the largest community of Cambodians in the state of California.
In the nation.
In the nation. Oh, my God. How many people are we talking about?
We estimate about 50,000 Cambodians.
So can I ask a really stupid question?
Go for it.
The best Cambodian restaurant in town has got to be here.
Yes, yes. Well, I believe so. For me, my favorite place, if you're very adventurous and really don't mind trying new foods and stinky foods, I would suggest going to Crystal's Thai Restaurant. They're located on 10th and Orange. It's a little hole-in-the-wall place, but they have home-cooked meals there.
But that's Thai.
They blend it. They say Cambodian Thai because us Americans are afraid to try new things like Cambodian food. And so
they're hiding behind Thai.
Mm-hmm, to attract new people to try the food. Mm-hmm.
By the way, a good branding message would not be if you don't mind stinky food.
Yes.
I'm giving you a suggestion on that.
But that's why I said adventurous.
All right, so what's the stinkiest food on the menu?
So we have something traditional called pahok. And what pahok is, it's a fermented fish paste. And we use that we use it as an ingredient. And so a lot of times it's integrated with other meats like pork, or ground chicken. And there's something called pahok gati, and we eat it with vegetables. But also you can put it in soup. But when you step your foot into Cambodia, that's what Cambodia smells like to me, is pahok. And so if you really want to experience Cambodian food, true Cambodian flavors, you would try pahok. But there are other...
I want you to hold that thought for a second, because I'm going to tell everybody the donut secret when we come back, all right?
Yes.
We've been talking to Susanna Sam from the United Cambodian Community here in Long Beach, and we were talking about the fact that it's the largest group of Cambodians in America.
Correct.
Right here in Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is Cambodian food, by definition, very spicy?
No. But there's a lot of flavors, so it's spiced. So it's very similar to Thai, Vietnamese, and Chinese food. So we have a lot of stews and soups and noodle dishes. Another place that I really enjoy is a Cambodian breakfast spot that's called the Phnom Penh Noodle Shack. And they were first opened in 1985. And it's literally a little house. And all the locals, all the Cambodian residents and families will go there. And it used to be one big table. And you would eat at the table as a family. Since then, they've expanded. And they've actually, their children has taken over the restaurant. And so now Phnom Penh Noodle Shack has a new location in Cerritos, California, which is about 30 minutes away from here.
You know, you talk about the noodle shop, a little known secret, but I'm going to reveal it now. Mm-hmm. Most donut shops in California are owned by who?
Cambodians.
Why?
So back in the 80s, a lot of our community members, they came here with nothing in their pockets. And living in high poverty. And one of the ways that the Cambodian community members, they're very resilient, very resourceful. And one of the ways is that one community member learned how to make donuts at a local donut shop and learned the business and the model. And so he taught it to other Cambodian families. And he's now known as the Donut King. I forgot his exact name. It's not off of the top of my head. But he... really help establish Cambodian donut shops. And so if you go to any donut shop here, I guarantee you they're probably owned by a Cambodian family.
And a little known fact, they have high profit margins.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a little overhead, which That means a lot of our commune members would be able to invest in a business, and they would have their families work the business. And then from there, they'll be able to make money to help support their families.
Now, of course, I've noticed this in donut shops not owned by Cambodians. I don't see a lot of fat people working there. You know why? Because they don't eat the stuff they're making.
They don't, and they wake up very early to bake their donuts, and they're hard workers. And so it just takes a lot of labor to own a donut shop.
Tell me about the United Cambodian Community.
So United Cambodian Community has been in the Long Beach community for over 40 years. It's the second oldest Cambodian organization here in Long Beach, and it was first established by Cambodian refugees who were helping themselves, and then from there established into a social service agency. Now we're in our 41st year, and we created a new mission and vision statement. Our new mission statement is that we elevate the Cambodian community through local engagement and leadership that embodies Cambodian cultural values. And our vision is a flourishing Cambodian community whose valuable contributions really benefit
the broader community
yeah. And also future generations.
But I think one of your other mandates must be to educate idiots like me about your impact, your culture, and your contributions.
Right. I think for us Cambodians, usually we have a survivor mentality. And back in Cambodia, a lot of the refugees, the way that they survived was that they made themselves invisible. And we're trying to shift that now, is that we really want to make the Cambodian community visible and really highlight our cultural richness and vitality. One of the things that's really important for us is that the Cambodian community experience is a lot different than the broader Asian community. The Asian community is usually identified as the model minority. And the model minority is that they are people of color that have high education and they have high economic opportunities and are doing well in our society. But when you actually disaggregate the data from Asian to Southeast Asian and specifically look at the Cambodian community, we look very similar to other communities of color. We look very similar to the African community, African American community, and the Latino community in terms of we have high poverty rates. We also have low graduation rates, in which 52% of our Cambodian adults do not have high school degrees, and only 16% of our Cambodian adults have bachelor's degrees or higher.
How do you change that cycle?
And that's how UCC is addressing our issues. I think it's through multiple strategies, because there's intersectionality of what causes these issues within the Cambodian community, but also the structure and the society that we live in today. There are a lot of Cambodians moved into Central Long Beach, which is known to have high poverty and high crime rates. And so the way that we address it is looking at policy, making policy change, but also investing in the next generation, being able to have trauma-informed care, and also have culturally competent services.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.